When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Tesco, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and our connection to our own humanity. This is episode 85. It's another joint episode with Melita Thomas of Tudor Times on Mary, Queen of Scots. Just a quick note that the Renaissance English History Podcast is a proud member of the Agora Podcast Network. You can discover lots of great new podcasts at agorapodcastnetwork.com. The Agora Podcast of the Month is Tiny Vampires. Tiny Vampires is a show about insects that transmit disease and the scientists that are fighting them. So if you are interested in mosquitoes and Zika and diseases, this is a really good one for you. Learn more at tinyvampires.com. Also, I need to thank a very special group of people right now, the lovely Patreon supporters of this podcast. This show is independent. I do it myself, always have, and as such, I am beholden only to you, the listeners. And so I ask for your support through Patreon. Those who signed up at the $3 an episode or higher level will get a Tudor planner in November as a thank you gift. And if you missed that promotion, don't worry, I'm working on another super cool one. And I'm always figuring out new ways to thank the show's patrons. So let me thank them here all right now. They are Kathy, Jurgen, Kendra, Anne Boleyn, also known as Jessica, which makes me smile every time I see it. Or maybe it's Jessica, also known as Anne Boleyn. Either way. Elizabeth, Cynthia, Judith, Ian, Laura, Barbara, Shar, Kiva, Amy, Allison, Joanne, Kathy, Christine, Annetta, Candice, Rebecca, Al, and Shandor. If you would like to join this very intelligent group of people, you can get all the links on the website at englandcast.com. So now, let me introduce you to Melita Thomas. Melita is a co-founder and editor of Tudor Times, a website devoted to Tudor and Stuart history in the period from 1485 to 1625. You can find it at tudortimes.co.uk. Melita, who has always been fascinated by history ever since she saw the 1970s series Elizabeth R with Glenda Jackson, also contributes articles to BBC History Extra and Britain Magazine.
What can you tell us? Mary, Queen of Scots, she had such a tumultuous life. And it's so hard to just try to talk about everything in just a couple of minutes because there was so much. But what can you tell us of like kind of the highlights of her life just to get us started?
She was a queen in her cradle. Her father died when she was about a week old, so there was no time in her life when she could remember not being a queen. And she was actually the first woman to be a queen in the British Isles, predating both her cousins Mary and Elizabeth. As well as being Queen of Scotland, she was Queen Consort of France, and there were a lot of people who thought she actually ought to be Queen of England as well. So she had a very exalted idea of her own status as a queen. I think the most fascinating thing about her is partly the level of fascination she still exerts after 500 years. People debate furiously as to whether she was very badly treated, a martyr, wrongly accused of murder and adultery, or whether in fact the suggestions, the accusations at the time that she was behind the assassination of her husband so that she could marry her lover. The debate continues to rage. I think she was one of those people who had personal charisma, which is something that you can't you can't put your finger on. You can't see it in the paintings of her because she was said to be, you know, very beautiful. But the paintings, I mean, standards of good looks change, but she doesn't seem anything special to modern eyes. But people talked of her as enchanting and charming and full of grace, and so that she must have had that whole personal aura that very, very occasionally people have, which made people totally devoted to her. There weren't many people who weren't charmed by her, but there were a few, and perhaps because she was used to charming everybody, she thought she could do it all the time, and perhaps didn't pay enough attention to some of the other political skills that she perhaps failed to develop as well as she might have done.
So very early on, at the start of her life, she became queen when she was, 6 days old. And it looked as if she was going to lead a really kind of normal life and go to France and be queen there. And then her husband died and it all kind of started to go wrong for her.
In some ways, it went wrong almost from the day she was born, because Scotland was a bone of contention between England and France. Both countries were bigger and more powerful, and they both wanted to control Scotland. Scotland and France had been an alliance for 300 years. You know, there were many Scots people who wanted to continue that alliance, and France was really only interested in Scotland to provide a threat to England if England were to invade France. So that was the idea. If England invaded France, then France would pay the Scots to invade England, and that was kind of the deal. But in the 1540s, when Mary was born, England, in the person of Henry VIII, thought that a young female queen was the best opportunity he would ever have to dominate Scotland. And he wanted Mary brought to England and married to his son, Edward. And there were a number of Scots people who thought this was actually a good plan as the Reformation was beginning to unfold in Scotland. But there were an awful lot who preferred the old French alliance. So throughout Mary's childhood, there was an ongoing war. They called it the War of the Rough Wooings. And the south of Scotland was devastated. Edinburgh was burnt. And, you know, it was huge misery. And the upshot was that it was agreed by most of the Scots that Mary would be safer in France. So she was sent there when she was only 5 years old and brought up and married the young king, Francois. But he died young. They'd only been married not even 18 months, I don't think. So after a brief hiatus, which one of her biographers thinks was one of the most damaging things she ever did, not returning to Scotland immediately that she was widowed, suggested that Mary was not actually that interested in Scotland and was far more interested in either being Queen of France or in promoting her claims to the throne of England. But at any rate, she did come back after 18 months and took up rule. But she was only 18, and I think we have to bear in mind that some of the mistakes she made, you know, how many of us would be wiser at the age that she was?
Can you walk me through, for people who aren't familiar with her lineage, where her claim to the English throne comes from and why she started to proclaim herself potentially? And a lot of that was down to her relatives kind of pushing that on her in France, wasn't it? Or can you tell me?
Yeah, it certainly was her father-in-law, Henry II of France, who pushed the claim, because obviously if he had the legitimate Queen of England in his hands, that would open up a whole world of possibilities to him. So the claim came from Henry VII and Elizabeth of York had various children, amongst whom were Henry VIII of England and Margaret, who married King James IV of Scotland. James IV had and Margaret Tudor had a son, James V, who married twice. And by his second, Marie of Guise, he had Mary. They had two little boys who very sadly died within a few days of each other, which is obviously heartbreaking for the parents. So therefore, Mary was the great niece of Henry VIII. Now, Henry, as we know, had all sorts of matrimonial escapades, which resulted in three children who survived him. He had another illegitimate son who died young. Now, Edward VI was generally reckoned to be a legitimate child and a male. So no contest there about him inheriting the throne. Henry's older daughter, Mary, was viewed by the vast majority of people as legitimate, although Henry had claimed that his marriage to her mother was illegal and that Mary was therefore illegitimate, and she was only permitted to inherit the throne by Act of Parliament. Then Henry's third child, Elizabeth, Catholics thought was illegitimate. So therefore, when Queen Mary of England died, her nearest adult heir was Mary, Queen of Scots.
And she would have been considered, Elizabeth would have been considered illegitimate because when she was born, Catherine of Aragon was still alive, right? That's like the key part that makes her. Okay. So there she is, and she's, didn't she at one point have to actually, or they had her put the coat of arms, match England with hers, and she was kind of pushing it for a while there. Wasn't she?
Yeah. So what happened when Mary the First of England died, Henry the Second of France immediately proclaimed that his daughter-in-law, Mary Queen of Scots, was Queen of England. And yes, the royal arms of England were quartered with Mary's own, and it was engraved on her plate and so forth. And this became a real bone of contention and was probably one of the things, again, that led to much more trouble for Mary in the future. Because when her husband dies, and once he had died, Mary stopped overtly claiming the crown of England. So, you know, one can question whether she actually thought that it had been a good idea or whether she really believed that she had those claims at that time. She was, all she ever demanded personally from Elizabeth that she should, was that she should be acknowledged as Elizabeth's heir. The very fact that the claim had been made a number of Elizabeth's ministers, who were Protestants, very, very wary of Mary. There was a treaty that had been agreed between the Scottish lords and the English government in a very complex civil war that was being fought while Mary was still in France. And by this treaty, the Treaty of Edinburgh, it was they wanted Mary to agree that she was not the rightful Queen of England. And Mary refused to ratify the treaty unless Elizabeth agreed that she was the legitimate heir. So it all got very argumentative, and that remained a bone of contention. But Mary herself was content to be considered the heir, but she did pursue a policy that was very much geared towards that recognition, perhaps to the exclusion of other more sensible policies that she might have pursued.
So, okay, so there she is in France. Her husband dies. She's back in Scotland. And can you just kind of give us the synopsis of what the situation was like that she found herself in Scotland, and then kind of what happened with her personal decisions that
she came back to a Scotland that had in her absence and during this period that this historian Dr. Wormald thinks was so vital, the Scottish Parliament had passed an act that made Protestantism the official religion of Scotland. Now, Mary herself was a Catholic, and although in her youth she doesn't seem to have been, you know, more than conventionally religious, like most people of the time, she became more interested in religion as she grew older. She agreed with the Protestant lords, who were effectively in control of Scotland, that she would return from France. She wouldn't interfere with Protestants as the Protestantism as the official faith of Scotland, provided she personally could continue her Catholic worship. And that was agreed. And she was true to her word. She never at any time tried to reinstate Catholicism, even though there were plenty of people who would have supported it, both in Scotland and abroad. And every effort to ensure that the Protestant church flourished in Scotland. So she came back, and her main supporter at that time was her illegitimate half-brother, Lord James Stuart, whom she afterwards made Earl of Murray. Now, he was a very talented politician, Murray, and she was, as I said before, considered attractive and charming, and many people became very infatuated with her as a personality. And she and her half brother got on well, and all went quite smoothly. She perhaps put more trust in her half brother than he necessarily merited. She became involved in factional fighting that really, when you stand back, was more for his benefit than for the benefit of the crown. But then as time passed, she wanted to exert her own authority more. And she also wanted to marry because she wanted, like every monarch, she needed to leave an heir. And her choice, the difficulties were choosing a right husband without aggravating the Queen of England, because Mary's policy was still her desire to be acknowledged as Elizabeth's heir. But all Elizabeth would do was tell her who she couldn't marry. She wouldn't tell her who she could marry or who the English would approve of. And eventually Mary got tired of this and she married her cousin, Lord Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley, who was another descendant of Henry VII, again, the complicated Tudor-Stuart family tree. Now, a lot of her nobles disliked Darnley, in particular her half-brother Murray. And very quickly after marrying Mary, Mary realised that she'd made a huge mistake because Darnley was, it's sad to say, but the poor man, he died when he was 21, and there is not a single soul who's ever said a good word about him apart from his mother. He was, you know, maybe he would have grown out of it, but at 19, 20, he was spoilt, he was arrogant, he treated Mary very disrespectfully. He demanded all the trappings of power, but didn't really want to do any work. He drank heavily. He humiliated her by, you know, consorting with prostitutes. It was a terrible decision, even though on paper it looked quite good. So, I mean, the culmination of their appalling relationship was when he got involved in a plot to assassinate her secretary. Then, so everybody disliked Darnley. He was trouble. He was everybody wanted to see the back of him. And a group of nobles and Mary, they discussed the problem of Darnley. And Mary was assured by her nobles that they would find a way out of the situation. Mary said to them that, yes, she wanted to find a way out of the marriage with Darnley. She didn't want her honour impugned in any way, and she and Darnley had had a child, so she didn't want any suggestion that the marriage hadn't been valid because it would affect the legitimacy of her son. So she left them to cook up an idea to get rid of him without impugning her honour. Now, whether she herself thought this through, or whether, you know, it's difficult to imagine what anybody could have had in mind other than assassination. But Mary said that she had no thought of such a thing. Anyway, the upshot was that there was an explosion in Darnley's house and he was found dead in the garden, probably strangled. In fact, he'd tried to escape. You know, and debate has raged for centuries as to whether Mary actually was involved, whether it was a complete shock and surprise to her. It's very hard to know because I've been debating it in my own mind. You think, okay, if she knew that they were going to murder Darnley, and, you know, there was a whole group of them in it, why didn't she act as any other sensible monarch would have done? As Elizabeth wrote to her urgently, her mother-in-law, Catherine de' Medici, wrote to her urgently and said, find the perpetrators, hang the perpetrators. And, you know, it sounds harsh, but there were plenty of other monarchs who'd, you know, dispatched a few unlucky underlings and, you know, rounded up a few innocent people and hanged them and pinned the blame on them. So if she was involved, why didn't she do that? You know, find a scapegoat. But on the other hand, if she wasn't involved, again, she made no real efforts to actually find the perpetrators. And it was very, very soon decided that the main perpetrator was the Earl of Bothwell, who was distinctly unpopular with some of his fellow nobles. But, you know, so it's possible that the rest of them had got together and decided that he was going to be the fall guy. You know, the whole thing, it's very, very hard to disentangle why Mary didn't proceed against Bothwell. And the explanation that was given at the time was that she and Bothwell were in it together and that they were lovers. But there doesn't really seem to be any contemporary evidence that is, you know, that can't be questioned, that she and Bothwell were having any kind of relationship at that time. So, you know, the whole thing's a mystery. But the, you know, matters got worse because as Mary paid little attention to actually getting finding the murderers, a private prosecution was actually brought by Darnley's father, the Earl of Lennox, against Bothwell, who turned up with a large body of men, frightened Lennox's men off. So Lennox didn't turn up to the trial and Bothwell was acquitted. And the next thing we know is Bothwell abducted Mary. And again, you know, people said, was she in it? Did she, you know, was she part of it? Or was it a shock and a surprise to her? He took her off to Dunbar Castle and either he raped her or they, you know, continued their love affair. The whole thing just, no matter how, and which is why, of course, after 500 years, people still debate it, because it's very difficult to find a logical answer that covers everything that happened. At any rate, because she then married Bothwell, and that was the end. Now her reason that she gave for marrying him was that he produced a bond which had been signed by many of her nobles, saying that they would be very happy if she married Bothwell. But again, you've got to ask the question, why did she accept that? Why didn't she think about it and say, no, this man has forced me, I'll have him? You know, you can't imagine Elizabeth letting somebody rape her and not ending up in a bad way, can you? Very strange. However, she decided to marry Bothwell for good or bad reasons, and I've wondered whether she had Stockholm syndrome. You know, that the thing that they've identified that hostages sometimes get, they start to identify with their captor and are almost mesmerized by them. Perhaps that's what happened to Mary. I mean, it's about 10% of hostages develop it, so she may have been one of them. Anyway, the two of them, they raised an army and they confronted the nobles who now were in open revolt at Carberry Hill. But rather than fighting, Mary agreed that she would surrender if Bothwell had a safe conduct to leave the country. And she adamantly refused to hand him over, which, again, if, you know, if he had raped and abducted her, you'd think she'd be glad to do. But, you know, she didn't. Anyway, she thought that by surrendering to the lords, she would be reinstated and everything would carry on as normal. But they had very different ideas. They clapped her in a castle at Loch Leven, and she was in appalling health by this stage. She had a miscarriage. She was depressed. She was ill, and, you know, not surprising. And she was, you know, physically bullied and terrorized into abdicating. She got better, and clever and charming as ever, she managed to persuade the brothers of the man who owned the castle to help her escape. So, you know, she really did have a silver tongue. Raised another army, and but was on her way to Dumbarton Castle. Now, had she reached Dumbarton Castle in Glasgow, the whole thing would have been very, very different, because Dumbarton was impregnable. It's only, you know, it's the oldest continuously inhabited fortress in the British Isles, dates from the 500s, and has never, or no, I think it fell twice to the Vikings, I think. But other than that, you know, you're pretty much, once you're in there, you're safe. But she was intercepted by Murray and his army and heavily defeated at the Battle of Langside. Although she had more men, she didn't have such good commanders. And then she made another mistake. Instead of you know, going to ground in the Highlands and perhaps raising another army, certainly a possibility, or even going back to France, she elected to go to England.
And so then she becomes Elizabeth's. I can imagine Elizabeth must have thought, like, what luck that this is blown up on my shore. Talk to me a little bit about the relationship between her and Elizabeth, because in some ways it seems like Elizabeth was insecure and jealous of her, like the reports that she would ask things like who's prettier and who's taller and who's the better dancer and things like that of the ambassador. And at the same time, she held so much, she held Mary's life in her hands then, as it turned out. And they never actually met, but they exchanged letters. So tell me a little bit about kind of how that relationship went.
Yeah, it's a very interesting one. Yeah, despite all of the Hollywood efforts to envisage a meeting, it never did occur. Mary had wanted a meeting since she returned to Scotland, and at one time it did look as though Elizabeth would agree, but Elizabeth very often appeared to agree to things that never actually happened. Yeah, you're right. She was very jealous of or envious of Mary's. I mean, as I mentioned before, Mary was considered exceptionally attractive and beautiful and all those things, and Elizabeth and clearly was attractive to a degree, but she was very vain of her appearance, and she certainly never wanted to hear that the Queen of Scots was better looking than her. Mary also had something that Elizabeth didn't have, which was a more secure position as a queen, because as we were discussing before, you know, there were many people who thought Elizabeth was illegitimate. So there was always a fundamental insecurity in Elizabeth's claim to her throne, which was not the case for Mary. No one could ever question Mary's right to be Queen of Scotland. And then Elizabeth, of course, she, although in some ways it was lucky for her that, and probably luckier that she came, that Mary came to England and went to France, but it did put Elizabeth in a very difficult position, because she couldn't really be seen to be supporting rebels against a lawful monarch. As soon as you start supporting rebels against one monarch, you're just opening the door to the same thing happening to you. So throughout this whole period, Elizabeth never wanted to admit that, you know, that the nobles of Scotland had been right to depose Mary. But at the same time, she preferred a Scottish government led by Murray and the subsequent regents, because it was more formally Protestant, although, as I said before, Mary had never interfered with religion in Scotland. And of course, Elizabeth could play on the insecurities of a scarcely legitimate government to control what was going on in Scotland much more. So she was very much in a cleft stick about being seen to support rebels. And the way she dealt with it was to effectively say, well, she couldn't possibly put Mary back on her throne until Mary had demonstrated that she was innocent of these charges of murder and adultery. So what happened, Elizabeth set up a commission to investigate the charges, and after a good deal of to-ing and fro-ing and discussion and the appearance of those documents known as the casket letters, which may or may not have been forgeries but appeared to implicate Mary in the assassination, Elizabeth decided that nothing had been proved against her, but on the other hand, no, she couldn't really be said to have completely exonerated herself. So while Elizabeth thought about what to do, Mary was her honoured guest. And that's what happened. So she wasn't going to help Mary get back to Scotland, but she wasn't going to send Mary back hand and foot tied to the Scots government, who would have executed her. So there was Mary for 19 years drifting about the castles of the Midlands under increasingly severe restrictions, as she tried to escape. And, you know, who can blame her? She did warn Elizabeth. She said, if you hold me, I will, you know, you have no right to hold me. I'm a sovereign queen. I'm not a subject of England, and I will do everything I can to escape.
And it's interesting, because we talked about her in the context of earlier Bess of Hardwick and how her being there impacted their marriage, and it's just interesting all the different people who were impacted by what was happening with Mary, Queen of Scots, and it's just an interesting kind of side effect of it, that she sort of destroyed Bess of Hardwick's marriage, I suppose.
She did, yeah. The poor old Earl of Shrewsbury, he was driven demented by it. And Elizabeth was never very keen on handing over the money, but she was determined that Mary had to be kept quite strictly, partly because Mary had already shown that she could talk her way out of quite a few situations. And there was a great deal of concern that she would talk her way out of one of Elizabeth's castles as well. And there were, as time passed, the Catholic Protestant divide in England became stronger. In 1569, the Earls of Westmoreland and Northumberland rose up against Elizabeth and tried to reinstate the Catholic religion. The Pope, having not said anything about Elizabeth really in the 1560s, then excommunicated her and freed her Catholic subjects from allegiance to her. And all of this made perhaps not Elizabeth herself so much, but certainly her ministers absolutely paranoid. Her chief ministers, Cecil and Walsingham, were Puritans, or certainly Walsingham was. Perhaps Cecil wasn't quite a Puritan, but and they were, you know, the very idea of a Catholic queen just made their hair stand on end. So they assumed she was behind every Catholic plot. And in a way, the thought became father to the deed, because they Walsingham certainly entrapped Mary. The final plot, which came at the end, the Babington plot, it was, you know, very largely set up by Walsingham. I mean, clearly you can't inveigle somebody into treason who isn't interested, but, you know, there was definite entrapment there. But they thought they were doing the right thing, I suppose.
And so then she was executed, and that whole, it was just such a massive thing to have one queen execute another queen, and it really plagued on Elizabeth. I read something that when she died, she was still, like, her last words were, you know, Mary or something like that. Can you talk about the decision of how they chose to execute her and how that played out, and then kind of the lasting effects of it? I mean, it kind of was the pretense that Philip used to invade with the Spanish Armada then too, right? So,
well, yeah, that was certainly part of, and that was part of the reason why this, why relationships between England and Spain deteriorated quite seriously in the 1580s. In the earlier years of Elizabeth's reign, Philip and was inclined to maintain the traditional Anglo-Spanish alliance against the Scottish-French alliance. So it was sort of the two sides sort of drew up like that. But England became involved, not necessarily with Elizabeth's wholehearted approval, but she was drawn into supporting the rebels in the Netherlands. Now, Elizabeth, by and large, was more interested in supporting her fellow monarchs and supporting her co-religionists. But she was sort of driven into a position where she had to give support to the Protestants of the Netherlands against the Spanish, their Spanish overlord, King Philip. And so, again, the whole Catholic Protestant thing started to get more and more polarized. So Philip, obviously angry at Elizabeth's interference in the Netherlands, now started to think that actually, you know, he needed to interfere in England and potentially put Mary on the throne. So that was part of the lead up to the Spanish invasion in 1588, and the plethora of plots that either real or manufactured that occurred in the 1580s. So Elizabeth was persuaded eventually that as long as Mary lived, these plots would continue, because with Mary dead, her heir would then be Mary's son, James of Scotland, who had been brought up as a Protestant. So Elizabeth was eventually persuaded that Mary should die. I mean, probably the last straw was a letter that was written to Mary and smuggled in a beer barrel to the house where she was staying and living in, you know, being held at Chartley in Staffordshire. Now, Walsingham knew everything that was going in and everything that was going out, because he was, the whole thing was a setup. And Mary received a letter saying that six gentlemen would assassinate Elizabeth, and they would then come and free her, and she would have a glorious future as Queen of England. And Mary, in her response to this letter, did not say, do not assassinate Elizabeth. She didn't explicitly say, go ahead and do it. But the way she worded her letter, it was clear that she accepted that that was what was going to happen. So once Walsingham had this letter in his hand, and his secretary drew a little gallows on it when he received it, because effectively Mary had hanged herself, they persuaded Elizabeth that the Queen should be tried. She was tried and found guilty, and it was a while before Elizabeth could bring herself to sign the death warrant, because once a monarch's killed another monarch, you know, you've opened the floodgates. Elizabeth, she was damned if she did and damned if she didn't.
Interesting. And then the story of Mary, Queen of Scots, when she died in her tiny little puppy.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Hiding under her skirts. Yes. Yeah. She died very bravely. As I said before, she didn't, whilst she was in Scotland, show a lot of interest in religion other than her personal faith, but she seemed to become more genuinely religious as she grew older, and she, you know, she could have, her life would have been a lot easier if she'd converted to Protestantism when she went to Scotland. Things might have turned out very differently, but she wouldn't do that, and by the end she did see herself as a martyr for her religion.
So where can we learn more about her?
Well, there are so many books and about Mary, and so much debate. And the most well known, or the great biographies of her, is by Lady Antonia Fraser, Mary, Queen of Scots. It's a little dated now in some ways. Some of the sort of gender politics we would be surprised by now, but I mean, it is a very, very comprehensive and detailed work. Dr. Jenny Wormald, a very well-known Scottish historian, has written wrote in the late 80s, so about 20 years after Antonia Fraser, a book called Mary, Queen of Scots, A Study in Failure. And it's her contention that Mary was a completely useless queen, regardless of whether she had anything to do with Darnley's murder. You know, she made so many other mistakes that she brought it on herself. So it's an interesting breath of fresh air compared with some of the very positive biographies. Dr. Linda Porter's Crown of Thistles is excellent. Very, very nice, very balanced, very beautifully written. So highly recommend that one. Rosalind Marshall, who's a Scots historian, she's written a rather nice one about Queen Mary's Women, it's called, and it's little pen portraits as well of Mary herself, of her mother Marie of Guise, her grandmother Antoinette of Bourbon, her mother-in-law Margaret Lennox. So that's very interesting for some background. And there are numerous clubs and societies and all the rest of it who talk about Mary, Queen of Scots. And when you go to Scotland, I mean, you know, it's tartan, it's shortbread, and it's Mary, Queen of Scots. She is perhaps more popular there now than she was in the 1560s.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to explain her to us. And she's such an interesting person.
Yeah, I mean, I still can't decide about her. Whether she was guilty or whether she was not guilty. But I think there is a very nice quote that perhaps to end on, which I will. This was written by one of Cecil's men who went to visit her, and they were all terrified that she would, charm everybody into letting her go. Anyway, this was in the 1570s or early 80s. She has withal an alluring grace, a pretty Scotch accent, and a searching wit, clouded with mildness. Fame might move some to relieve her, and glory joined with gain might stir others to adventure much for her sake.
Thank you again to Melita Thomas for taking the time to tell us about Mary, Queen of Scots. For more information, go to tudortimes.co.uk, or you can also see the resources available on the Englandcast site at englandcast.com. Remember, if you like this show, the biggest way you can help it is to leave a review on iTunes. That's the best thing you can do, and it's free. So leave a review on iTunes, or if you have any Tudor-loving friends, you can also tell them about it. Chances are they probably haven't heard about it, so go on and tell your friends. The next episode in about 2 weeks is going to be the second episode on food and table manners, and then we are getting into Reformation Month, dun, 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 which is in October. It's to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the 95 Theses. I'm doing a lot of episodes on the Henrican Reformation and ecclesiastical history in England. So if you're a nerd like me, you will love it. That's October. Talk with you again soon. Bye-bye. Sinful Mary's waiting, blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow. Here is dead a worth in dying, grazie, who's a stoughton guy.